And we will go on to the last case of the day. And that case is 083370, and it is United States versus Barnador Sutton. And Mr. Scott, are you on the telephone?
Yes, Your Honor, I am on the phone.
No, you're not. You're Miss Scott. I'm sorry. You have a very beautiful name, but it's one that I could not. Never mind. Hello, no, Miss Scott.
Hello. It's okay. It's a Hebrew male name, so it's a common confusion that I get.
Okay. Go right ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel for the government. The district court clearly erred when they applied the six-level enhancement based upon the number of victims exceeding 250. We look at the application note that corresponds with United States Sentencing Guidelines Section 2B1.1B2C. It specifically states that in the definition of victim that a victim must suffer pecuniary harm. And in this case, the two victims that suffered pecuniary harm were Indiana Medicaid and the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, which was actually noted by the district court in their commentary when they stated that the recipients, the Medicaid recipients, that is, were not financially impacted by the harm caused by Mr. Sutton.
Ms. Scott, is the depletion of one's Medicaid benefits necessarily a non-pecuniary loss? For instance, what if one of Sutton's victims seeks to use his or her Medicaid benefits for counseling? Would she be forced to pay out of her own pocket?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe they would. It appears, from the evidence, as though once the fraud was discovered, it was immediately remedied by Indiana Medicaid, which would mean that any of the Medicaid recipients that would have sought treatment that they did not actually receive would have been able to actually to get that treatment despite the fact that their funds had been used. So there was
that was dependent, was it not, on whether or not the bureaucrats got around to reinstating their allowance for this particular type of medical service.
That is correct, Your Honor. However,
and so, in the meantime, they really would have a problem obtaining those services.
Your Honor, the facts of this particular case seem to suggest that once the fraud was discovered, it was immediately remedied.
Okay. Well, you've used the word suggest several times. What does the record actually show with respect to the Medicare and Medicaid accounts of these individuals? Were they entirely depleted? Did the government, in fact, immediately reinstate them? Did anybody apply for benefits and actually was denied because of a depleted account? What does the record show?
Your Honor, I believe the record shows that they were immediately reinstated, and I do not believe the record in any way, shape, or form shows that anyone attempted to seek services and were denied for services. The way that this was brought to the attention of the government was that someone, I believe, received an explanation of benefits, and they contacted Indiana Medicaid inquiring why they had received the explanation of benefits when they had not received treatment, type of treatment.
At sentencing, did the district court explicitly pass on this question and make findings of fact?
Pass on the question of whether or not their funds were depleted. The district court, when discussing this, specifically stated, I believe, that they stated that that there was a sense of the district court stated in the sentencing transcript at page 14. Apologize, you can't point at each of these victims and say they lost a dollar or 50 cents, but there is a loss to these victims, which in our estimation acknowledged means that the district court is acknowledging that there was no monetary loss or pecuniary harm to any of the Medicaid recipients whose Medicaid identification numbers were used.
What did the PSR have to say about the issue?
Your Honor, the pre-sentence report did apply the six-level enhancement based upon the information, based upon the number of victims that was submitted to it. I believe the government submitted the number of victims, identifications that were used, and so they did apply the enhancement, and that's when we objected to that enhancement based upon the language in the application note of the sentencing guidelines.
I understand, but did the district, did the PSR indicate whether the funds, anyone had applied for benefits and had been refused, or whether the government had in fact replenished those accounts immediately upon discovering the fraud?
Your Honor, the pre-sentence report did not specifically address that.
Thank you.
And in continuing with this issue, the government attempts to compare the facts on this case to United States versus Curran from the First Circuit Court of Appeals, which is problematic because the victims in that case actually suffered pecuniary harm in that they actually had to pay the bills for the services that were received. So they received services and then were billed for those services. So there's a key distinction between Mr. Sutton's case and the current case that is cited by the government. The district court also erred in applying a 20-level enhancement for loss based upon the loss amount being greater than $7 million. The burden with regard to loss is on the government, and there were 10 witnesses that testified at trial, which is a relatively de minimis portion of the claim. And so that's not enough to render all of the claims fraudulent in this case, because we're dealing with a very low number of the actual Medicaid recipients' identification.
Well, you claim, forgive me, I know it's hard because you can't, you know, see when we want to interrupt, but you claim that Sutton's business provided some legitimate services. Was there any evidence at trial as to the value of those services? Did either Ruth Haggerty or Darren Green testify at trial to providing those services?
Your Honor, there was no testimony regarding the value of the services. However, both Darren Green did testify that he provided some services for Mr. Sutton's company. And, in fact, when Dr. Haggerty was on the stand, she acknowledged some of the treatment plans that were introduced into evidence. She acknowledged that she had signed off on the treatment plans for those patients, and those patients were part of the psychotherapy services portion of Mr. Sutton's business. The issue, as we see it, is that the burden is on the government to prove the loss. It's not on Mr. Sutton to prove that the loss did not happen. And they did not do that. You know, 10 people out of, roughly 2,000, it's an awfully low number. There's a sharp difference between the approximately $42,000 of proven intended loss at trial and the roughly $9 million that they imposed at the time of sentencing. There's just a huge difference when it wasn't substantiated by any type of evidence that was placed before the court. The government's assertion is that Mr. Sutton should have disproved the loss amount, and that's contradictory to their obligation to prove the loss amount.
Did you argue in the district court that Sutton did not really expect Medicaid to reimburse him for the full amount billed?
Your Honor, at the district court level, no, we did not make that argument.
And why would he continue to bill over $2,000 for each claim if he never expected to receive more than $1,600?
Your Honor, the evidence at trial is that Mr. Sutton had previously worked with the Indiana Family and Social Services Agency. He was familiar with the way that the claims were paid out. So he would have known based upon his experience that they don't pay the full amount of the claim. That's just the way that was just the way that he billed it.
But, I mean,
Your Honor, I don't have a specific answer as to why he would have billed it that way versus for the actual amount that was paid out. I believe that that was just a matter of course. In looking at the records and the evidence, that was the matter of course that he had billed from the beginning, and so it was just continually that way. However, it should be noted, if you look at the billing pattern, that he was never paid more than the $1,600 per claim. So he would have, at least at some point, arguably known that they would not have paid out that full $1,600, I mean, the full $2,000 that was billed for, that it was simply a matter of course in the way that he was billing, because it would have become obvious at some point, even if he didn't know it at the beginning, that they do not pay that for any of the claims. That was the actual maximum that they paid on the claim. So he couldn't have intended to receive $2,000 when, in fact, that's not what they pay. And the record is also not clear whether or not the district court judge would have given the same sentence if the guideline calculation were different. It appears that the district court judge, when making his analysis of the 3553A factors, was guided by the guideline calculation. And the guideline calculation at that time called for a sentencing range that substantially exceeded the statutory maximum. So it is our contention that despite the government's position that the sentence is deemed reasonable, based upon the judge's 3553A analysis, it is our position that in the event that this court should grant either of the reductions to the guideline range, that it should be remanded to the district court so that they can reconsider his sentence in light of the new guideline calculation and the 3553A factors, because it is not clear that he would have given the 10-year sentence otherwise.
Ms. Scott, why isn't it clear, though, that the judge would have imposed the maximum sentence here of 120 months in any event? I'm referring to pages 26 and following of the sentencing transcript, and he does seem to make it clear that the huge, broad scope of this fraud was simply beyond the pale, and he was going to impose under Section 3553A the maximum sentence.
Your Honor, we don't believe that it is clear from his analysis that he would have imposed the maximum sentence anyway in light of the 3553A factors. If you look at the judge's analysis, it's fairly clear that he was conducting the 3553A analysis in light of the guideline in light of the calculated guideline range, and an attempt to justify why the guideline range was appropriate in this case, which in our estimation is distinctly different than the judge stating, these are the calculated guidelines, this is the range. Now I'm going to separate, so I'm going to take the guidelines away and then discuss the 3553A factors and make a determination as to why a 120-month sentence is appropriate despite the guidelines. And that's not what was done here. So it's not clear whether or not he would have imposed that if the guideline calculation were different.
Okay. The red light has been on.
Oh, thank you.
I actually didn't notice it. I'm sorry.
Thank you, Your Honors. Winfield Long for the United States. Test that Ms. Scott's an even more impressive advocate in person than she is over the phone. I want to make three points, perhaps in some reverse order of significance. First, with regard to the amount of loss, the government's entire case was essentially an effort to prove a negative. It was essentially putting in front of the jury all the efforts the government had made in its investigation to find any proof, any evidence that any services had been provided by Mr. Sutton's psychotherapy business, and that it had come up blank at every turn. That was the government's entire case, and it was successful in resulting in a conviction of Mr. Sutton on the charges. And to require any kind of statistical analysis of that would have been additionally of other kinds of claims would have been a pointless exercise given the overwhelming weight of the evidence at trial that there was no business at all.
Did the government present evidence that the individuals whose Medicaid ID numbers were used by Sutton actually lost all their counseling benefits such that they could not use services to which they were entitled.
That's true, Your Honor. With regards to the number of victims, I think the evidence was, in fact, that about 95% of the over 2,000, I think almost 2,500 victims, people whose identities, Medicaid benefits were used, had their entire annual or 12-month period benefits exhausted by Mr. Sutton's scheme. Now, in light of the questions we're asked of Ms. Scott, I should make clear.
Is that the precise question, though? I thought the inquiry had to do with whether they attempted to use them and were denied.
Yeah, well,
operative inquiry.
I'll address that. I'll address that, Judge Sykes. The government, in its process of interviewing victims through the investigation, came across obviously the 10 that we used, a number more. Very similar. We picked 10 essentially at random to present at trial. But I will concede that none of the people we talked to or interviewed said that they had gone back to receive benefits that were not provided. There was a mechanism that they could go to Medicaid if they were denied and said, hey, I didn't actually use any of these benefits. I don't know what this is about. And Medicaid could waive through a bureaucratic process at their discretion the limits on the benefits if they chose to and give people additional benefits. And so we did not really rely on an actual loss to these people. The only alternative the government had at that point would have been to just interview victim by victim by victim up to the however many it took to find people who actually did try.
But that is then the difference between the Curran case and this case, because the witnesses in Curran actually paid money for the fraudulent services. Here, we don't have our victims suffering pecuniary loss as such, do we?
I think that is true, Your Honor, although I emphasized in my brief that I felt that reading Curran closely, it seemed clear to me. The First Circuit was not concerned about the actual loss. They emphasized over and over the intrusiveness and the harm to these people through unnecessary procedures and how integral that was. I think they used the term a couple of times, intertwined in the fraud scheme. And just were generally, I think, the First Circuit offended by the use of these people in these tests to get other kinds of benefits.
But the guideline requires actual pecuniary loss.
Right.
That's true, Your Honor.
And not an intangible such as that which you're describing.
Well, that's true. It was our argument in front of the district court that these were a kind of tangible benefit because it was so real. It wasn't just, not to minimize identity theft, but it wasn't just the taking of this person's identity or a credit rating that was out there attached to it. It was an actual benefit that these people had, a very tangible thing that have an economic benefit.
Well, but it was inchoate until they presented themselves for services and were denied and had to pay for themselves. So that's the whole problem here.
That's true.
Is that this theoretically could satisfy that guideline? It's just that we don't have evidence to show that in this case it did.
Well, that's true. And that was the government's choice to not go down that road, to rely on how interconnected these were, that they were a tangible benefit. And I would agree, it's at best a close question. We argued this in front of the judge as much, and my last point was going to be, as an analogy that these people deserved some kind of recognition for the harm they suffered, and I thought the Curran case was close to touching on that, saying this goes beyond a pure dollar-for-dollar loss, that the First Circuit seemed genuinely concerned and included just the fact that these people were subject to intrusive, unnecessary tests and were victimized on that basis alone.
And the alarming medical conditions that they were told they had, required even more horrendous tests. But I certainly agree with my brother Ripple that Judge McKinney I mean, you know, he found this to be beyond the pale. But if we were to remand, is there a way that Judge McKinney could give Mr. Sutton even more time?
I don't think the statutory maximum was 10 years.
So that's it.
So that was it. And I would emphasize strongly that, in particular, I'll note, as we do in our brief, pages 24 through 28 of the sentencing transcript, Judge McKinney, I don't think, could have been more clear. He gave, to use language from another case of this circuit, a searching evaluation and clearly articulated his intent to give the maximum sentence regardless of the guidelines, that he was offended by the even inchoate victimization of these Medicaid beneficiaries. It was a model of concise but clear and a searching analysis of, I'd suggest, of why he gave Mr. Sutton the statutory maximum in this case, and was, I think, quite clear that this was based on the 3553A factors, not on the guidelines alone. There are no further questions. The government will rest on its brief.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, Ms. Scott, you used up all your time, but if you have, I will give you one minute if you would like to add anything at all.
Thank you, Your Honor. If I could just respond briefly to the 3553A analysis that Judge McKinney did at the time of sentencing. I just think it's key when we look at the language contained within pages 24 to 28 of the sentencing transcript that we acknowledge that he was doing that in light of a guideline calculation that substantially exceeded the 120-month statutory maximum. So we believe that it is wholly appropriate for it to be remanded back to the district court so that he can make that analysis in spite of the amended guideline range for this court. Decide that one of the two guideline calculation challenges we made are appropriate. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Scott. Thank you, Mr. Ung. And the case will be taken under advisement. The court will stand in recess until Monday morning at 9:30. And thanks to one and all.